Accession number 29566, Reel 7.
And Spicer, Reel 7. So what happened after basic training, then?
I'll just mention something here before we go on to that, which I didn't mention before. Jankers, or being confined to barracks. This is a thing that we experience more in basic training, I think, than afterwards, because as you gradually get into the swim of things, people are so acclimatized to what you're doing that being put on a charge is not something that normally happens, because you're in the regiment, but during basic training you can find yourself being called over the coals for the most minute discrepancy. You can be charged for having dirty boots, not shaving, all manner of things, and really all it is extra duties. You could get 5 days, 7 days, 28 days. CB, confined to barracks. People get charged for going AWOL, which is absent without leave, otherwise known as on the run, going on the trot. They're usually fetched back to barracks by military police, charged under different sections of the military code, and then you're brought up in front of the commanding officer, and he will say to you, "Will you accept my punishment?" And if you're very wise, you say, "Yes, sir." If you're not very wise, he goes to a higher authority, and you usually then find you get a worse sentence than you would have got if you'd accepted his punishment in the first place. But normally it would consist of things like extra duties, being put in the cookhouse to peel tons and tons of spuds, washing out all the dirty, greasy dishes. And remember, all this has got to be done in addition to what you're doing yourself, cleaning your own kit, keeping your barrack room clean. So, you know, really, you haven't got time to... You don't know what time of day it is, really, because you're on the go from morning, noon and night. But, you know, I just mentioned that in passing. Now, coming on to basic continuation training, we found that what happened was we were told by our NCOs that we would be going on to continuation training, and all this meant really was that you moved house. You moved from the basic training block across the square, and I'm referring now to Colchester, across to another block on the opposite side of the square, where continuation training would continue for about, I think it was 4 to 6 weeks. And all this consisted of was more of what you'd experienced in basic training, only a much brisker pace. And also you learnt additional things like field craft, map reading, camouflage, in much greater detail than you'd done in basic training. But we also found that there was a much more of an air of relaxation. The drill instructors, corporals and sergeants, actually talked to you as human beings. You weren't bawled out all the time. And anyway, we got over the other side of the square, and we found that it wasn't too bad, really. It was hard going, but you got much more satisfaction out of what you were doing. There were there was much more work on the assault course. As I say, at greater pace, and they were really sort of pushing you to your absolute limit.
What was the assault course like then?
The assault course was quite exhilarating, I think, for most of us. It consisted of underwater tunnels that you had to crawl through. You'd hold your breath at one end and whizzed through as fast as you could, and there was an NCO at the end who used to drag you out by your collar and say, "You can breathe now, soldier." You ran through lots and lots of obstacles, bits of stick and barbed wire that they taught you how to run onto the barbed wire and lay down, and so your colleagues could follow on behind. They used to tread on your back, but it didn't hurt because you had a pack on your back, and all that type of thing, swinging across ditches full of mud and water on ropes, climbing up massive great rope netting pieces of equipment, balancing over planks that were perhaps 6 to 8 inches wide, and you're talking about being 25, 30 foot in the air, and all the time you're being encouraged from down below, you know, get over there, soldier, you can do it. And there were the odd cases where people couldn't do it, they had to turn around and come down, but more often than not, in the end, you got through. It wasn't too bad at all. Oh, and the other thing that they used to do was they used to throw thunder flashes at you. Now, a thunder flash is like an enormous great big banger, and these things, the NCOs used to have a striker on strapped onto their wrist, which was just like the rough side of a matchbox, and they used to hold these things in their hand and just run it across the top and just hurl it at people. And if you saw these things coming, the best thing to do was to get out of the way, because if they landed too close to you, you could be the subject of quite a nasty burn. One or two of the blokes did actually get nasty thunder flash burns. But more often than not, they used to just hurl them in your general direction, but not at you. And these created an imitation area where you know, you were being shelled or mortared. And that they're very loud and they're quite effective. It was quite, I wouldn't say fun, but it added to the reality of the thing.
You said you did fieldcraft as well. What did that entail?
Fieldcraft included pulling out everything that you could from natural undergrowth and stuffing it all over your body to try and camouflage yourself. I mean, camouflage then wasn't like it is today. You had to make do. I mean, they still do make do with what is surrounded, but we didn't have these khaki suits that the army have now. You're talking about in the days of either battle dress or these denims. But you had to improvise. You had to tear off branches and stuff them down your waist and stick them in your helmet. Anything to make your presence so that you couldn't be seen. They did use the camouflage paste that they still used. It was tins of green or khaki greasy material that used to rub all over your hands and face, but that was the only thing that we had. Everything else you had to use from what was available around you. You had to use this and conceal yourself as best you could. You would crawl into ditches, bushes, try and take up offensive positions, and the NCOs would then tell you which section would move off first, which sections would give covering fire to a section that was advancing. And this was done more often than not in silence. You try to be as quiet as possible, because if you're trying to take an objective, you don't want to make a noise. I mean, the only noise that you make, or we were told that you make, is when you scream your head off when you're in a bayonet charge. But other than that, you try and be as quiet and unobtrusive as possible.
Did they teach you how to move along, say, the skyline and things like that?
No, that came a bit later, because during the continuation training period, we were given lectures by officers that had come back from Malaya, and they told us the sort of situation there would be out there. But they also said that once we joined the battalion, those that were going to the Far East, more training in that type of air surroundings would be given. But I think at continuation training, we were, I think everybody was being sort of conditioned for what we then understood as conventional warfare. That would be sort of a European type scenario.
Had you changed your status from between basic training and continuation training? Because I think you joined the Essex, hadn't you? But had you joined the Suffolks on the start of the continuation training?
That came on in the last week of continuation training. What happened was we went through, as I say, 4 to 6 weeks of this training, where everything was much more intensified. And then I think it was the fourth or fifth week, we were all called outside, and we were told to take a 30-minute NAFI break. And this was quite unbelievable to us, because NAFI breaks in basic training are a bit of a laugh, really, because you're told 10 minutes NAFI break. So you whiz along to the NAFI, but you find there's a mile queue. So your 10 minutes is, you know, by the time you get to the queue, you've got to be back on parade. But 30 minutes, I mean, that is fantastic. So we managed to get in there, get some food, and then back. And once we got back to the barrack room, we were told to form up outside, because there was going to be quite an important announcement made. Now, when we went in, when we were called up, there were, in our platoon, there were 39 soldiers, or 39 buddies. Now, when we got over to continuation training, there were 33 of us. The six that didn't come over with us, they were told to report to the company office, because they would be posted elsewhere. And I think the reason was because they wanted a few military police, so they took two out for military police training. They wanted two for something else and two for something else. Although there was one chap, we found that whenever we were given lectures by the officers that had come back from the Malaya, would always stand up and start questioning the officers, so much so that we got the impression he was a bit of a commie. And he was really having a go at these officers and saying, well, we shouldn't be there in the first place, this, that and the other, you know, the communists had a right to do this, this and that. Funnily enough, he wasn't one that came with us. He disappeared. We never saw him again. Anyway, of the 33 that made it to the end, we were told that morning that we were going to join the Suffolk Regiment in Malaya. So we had to take our original hat badges off, there was a mixture. Essex, Royal Norfolk's, Beds and Hearts. And we got nice, new, shiny Suffolk Regiment hat badges, which we duly bent around, rubbed on the gravel to make them look as though they'd been worn a long time, and then after a while you can really polish them up so that they're like your original hat badge, because over the weeks, you know, all these little wrinkles that you learn, that you rub them on the gravel and get rid of all the rough edges so that they're nice and smooth, and then you can put your bluebell on and really buff them up so that they're really polished highly. I mean, if you look at any serviceman, even these days, his hat badge, if you look at that hat badge and look at a brand new hat badge, the difference is like chalk and cheese. It's rounded, it's polished, and the words on it, whether it be a regiment or corps, you can hardly distinguish because they're polished so much that the guys all almost polished the insignia out. But that's the mark of a trained soldier. So there we were, 33 of us, didn't know where Malaya was, most of us. We had no idea what was going on there. And that was it, basically. We were told that the training that we'd had come to an end. We would get 14 days embarkation leave. But when we got to the battalion, we would be given much more intensive training on the sort of area and conditions that we would expect.
How did you feel about the potential of going to Malaya? Because obviously you knew a little bit from the lectures what was going on there. And you joined as a national serviceman, hadn't you? Did it bother you?
I'm not sure whether it bothered us all that much. I suppose a few of us, I mean myself included, we were apprehensive. Although we'd been given lectures, I don't think the situation came out during those lectures as exactly what was going on. I mean, most of us, I don't think we didn't know where Malaya was, even. We knew it was in the Far East. We had no inclination what the whole situation was like. I think apart from reading the football results on the newspaper, guys of that age didn't take too many, they weren't political. They didn't take things in. And not only that, there wasn't a great deal at that time reported about the situation in Malaya. And don't forget, at the same time, 1950, the North Koreans had just crossed the 38th parallel in Korea, and I think that more or less took the headlines. Everything was about Korea. Malaya was shoved to one side. But I can't ever remember, in all honesty, reading very much about Malaya at all. Didn't know what it was about. So therefore, it was more or less an adventure to us. We were going on a boat, a big boat, and we were going to see sights that most of us would, in 1,000 years, would never dream of seeing. So it was a great adventure. With a little bit of apprehension. I don't think anybody was scared.
And was there any way that was marked of your finishing continuation training? Did you have passing out?
Yeah, we at the end of that, at the end of the continuation training, we had a passing out parade, and the passing out parade consists of not only our platoon, but there were, you must remember that when you joined up as a national serviceman, you are only conscious of your platoon at the time, but going on around you, there may be 8 or 9 other platoons all being trained at the same time by different NCOs. So you might get 8 or 9 lots of chaps all passing out at the same time, and the NCOs and sergeants of those individual platoons are very proud men. They want their platoon to be the best platoon on parade on that particular day. So you're given a little bit of a lecture before you go onto the parade ground that, look lads, this reflects on me. Woe betide any of you buggers that let me down today, because, you know, we're up for a bit of praise if my platoon comes out on top. So you're self-conscious of this, and not only that, you don't want to let yourself down, because you've gone through this 12 weeks initial, plus a further 4 to 6 weeks, and you think you're the bee's knees, and you're spit and polish from top to toe. And as I say, you don't want to let yourself down, and by this time you don't want to let the guys down that have been training it. Anyway, what happens is you form up in the morning, and you're told that you're going to parade in front of the garrison commander. He's got all his entourage behind him, all the staff, the permanent staff, the instructors, the RSM, and one platoon after the other marches onto the square, and you've got the regimental band, or the garrison band, I should say, because Colchester was a garrison. It's a garrison town, much like lots of other garrison towns around the country. And the garrison band leads you on, and you do a set amount of drill. It's marching past the garrison commander, about turn, arms drill, presenting arms, shouldering arms, open order march, right turn, left turn, the whole gambit that you've done through all these weeks of training. And I must say, I don't think anybody made any mistakes, and it's quite an achievement, really, to think that, you know, I came in perhaps 3 or 4 months ago, I didn't know one end of a rifle from another. A lot of them didn't even know what bluebell polish was, or they couldn't even wash their own socks or use an iron. But there you are, you're standing there in a uniform that you've ironed, pressed yourself, all your shirts done, you've done everything yourself, all your boots are polished, you've not had your mum behind you. So, you know, it's something that you can look back on and say, I've done this myself. And after you march past the garrison commander, and he gives each platoon a nice salute, and then you're marched off. You told to stand at ease. When I say marched off, you're not marched off the square, but you're marched off the actual parade part. And you come to a halt, you face the garrison commander, you ground arms, and you're told to stand easy. And then he goes into one of his wonderful speeches. He tells you that you're the finest body of men that he's ever seen in his life, and that you'll be a credit to any regiment or corps that you're posted to within the next 24, 48 hours. And he tells you what a wonderful bunch of blokes you are, and then he tolls off, and then you told by your NCOs, that's it lads, you can go back to the barrack room and take it easy for a little while, and we'll let you know what's going to happen. And then after that, you go back to your barrack room and you have a smoke or whatever. And then after a little while, our particular platoon, I mean, the same thing probably happens to other platoons as well, but I'm talking about our platoon in particular. We were called outside and we were told that we were going to get 14 days embarkation leave. And we were told that you'll get a travel warrant, take you home, you get a travel warrant, bring you back. Just go and enjoy yourself.
And obviously with the embarkation leave, you went home. How did your parents feel about the potential of you going to Malaya?
Well, in my particular case, I didn't tell them where I was going. Because whether or not they knew what was going on, I wouldn't know. Not only that, I had a type of mother that I'm pretty certain would have come up to the station with me. And an 18-year-old bloke doesn't want that, because not only is it embarrassing, you don't know how many other guys are going to bring their mother up, or their girlfriends, if they had girlfriends. I think most of us were quite naive on the girlfriend front at that time. But I didn't tell them. I just said I'd got 14 days leave. I didn't tell them it was embarkation leave. And I didn't tell them where I was going either.
One thing that just came up there, you said you were quite naive on the girlfriend front. Had you received any sort of personal hygiene lectures while you were in basic training?
In continuation training, I think we had some lectures. Not so much about don't go with girls, but you were given lectures on gonorrhea and syphilis. But I think that was about all. We didn't get too much on that side of it at all. It was a bit like Civvy Street in a lot of respects, because at that time, and even to present day, this country seems to be has got a taboo in teaching its youngsters about sex. Sex didn't come, you know, other than the bromide in the tea. But no, venereal disease, that we were shown what would happen to us if we went, I think it was just if we went with prostitutes. But other than that, you were left to your own devices.
But there was some explanation of potential consequences.
Yeah, yeah. Not a great deal, though.
How did you spend your embarkation then?
Me personally, I met up with my old mates. I played football. I went back to the firm that employed me. Saw a lot of my old friends there, pictures. I didn't drink very much at the time because, not a lot of young guys had a lot of money then. We didn't, you know, we had money for pictures, but we didn't go drinking or that sort of thing. Drugs was not in the scene then. Never heard of drugs. So.
Did you smoke?
Slight, and not too much. I did smoke a little bit, but not too much. But I increased my smoking.
Well, obviously that's one of the things that's changed in society. At that time, say with your platoon, would virtually everybody smoke?
Most blokes smoked, but there were a few that didn't smoke. Which, you know, is no problem, really. We found, I'll come on to the smoking bit a little bit more when we joined the battalion, because the non-smokers did have an input then.
But generally at that time, smoking was much more prevalent in something like the military, was it?
Yeah, I think quite a few blokes did smoke. I mean, I didn't smoke heavily, but I smoked, but not. I wasn't a sort of a 20 or 40 a day man.
And where did you get cigarettes from?
We used to get them from the NAFI. But again, a lot of chaps that smoked had cigarettes sent to them because, you know, 28 bob a week didn't go very far. Especially when you're sending 7 bob a week home, and then the rest of it you're buying stuff to clean your kit. So you haven't got a lot of money